Today is May 23rd, 2009. This is Conduit. The panel is the Stenchless Chamber Pot.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the Stenchless Chamber Pot, or putting his, what is it, putting historical details in your, historical details in your fiction, and I'm just going to let everyone introduce themselves, and we'll start down there with Dave, since he is special.
I am David Farland / Dave Wolverton. You can see from both of my signs, I write science fiction and fantasy, and I recently did a historical novel, so I actually put all sorts of historical details, and absolutely no science fiction or fantasy in my book.
What?
So I'm an expert on historical.
My name is Clint Johnson. I write historical fiction as well as fantasy. My first novel is going to come out in about 2 weeks, June 9th. It's the middle grade fantasy, Green Dragon Codex. You can find out more about it and about me at my website, clintjohnsonwrites.com. And as I said, I write historical fiction as well, and so use a lot of historical detail in my writing.
My name is Anne Chamberlain, and the title of this panel is very dear to my heart because my grandfather's name that they gave him in school was Chamber Pot.
Oh! Ow.
Creative, though.
You know, Anne and I are like, what, seventh cousins?
Yes.
Something? Yes. We're seventh cousins, I believe. So I got Chamberlain's, Wolverton's right off your side. So probably that joke has been, played on our family for generations, and we just don't know about it.
Yeah, my grandfather knew about it. I write historical fiction. I'm also on the board of the Historical Novel Society, which will have its third North American conference in Chicago next month.
I'm Jessica Day George, apparently they trust me enough to moderate. I'm the author of the Dragons, the First Trilogy, but also Sun and Moon, Ice and Snow, which is a retold Norwegian fairy tale set in 19th century Norway. I minored in Scandinavian studies. I know all about the Scandinavia of yore. And I think that's why I love your idea. But let's go. So the Stenchless Chamber Pot. And I'm thinking, how much detail is too much detail? You've done your research, you know all about 19th century England. Where do you think you've crossed the line into we did not need to know how to hook the carriage to the horses?
You know, that's a good question, because I read a few years ago there was a really popular historical novel that was out that I started reading, and there were like 4 pages on how to churn butter. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I just want to put gun in my mouth and blow my head off. But, meanwhile, everybody seemed to love it, It was Gerald Lund.
Oh, The Work in the Glory?
Work in the Glory.
Oh, good golly. I never made it past chapter 1 in the first book for that reason.
So I loved the fact that the historical detail was there. But for me, I already knew how to make butter because I'd done it as a kid. And I didn't really need all of that detail. And even if I did need the detail, or didn't like the detail, I didn't need it in the story. It wasn't advancing a plot at all, So it was sort of it was overkill. And I think that's an individual thing. There are certain things where I think it's an obvious sort of follow your heart and what fascinates you. And if you want to know the art of medieval sword making, and you want to throw that in your book, and so you've got a smith and you want to show that your smith really knows how to make swords, I think there are people who will love that, but it's not going to be for everybody. You realize that you're cutting down your audience, or you can have a little place that says, skip to page 43 if you don't want to read about
your
story.
My son, who keeps thinking I should put my books online, is
that anytime I want to put all of that stuff in. But that, I think it's a different personality, maybe for each book and definitely for each author, of how much goes in and whether it should be there. Because I know all kinds of people who say, oh, well, science fiction books, I can't read them. They go on too long about the worlds or they built, or they, you know.
Faster than light travel.
Just too much. And, you know, those, but I'm sure that most of this audience eats that stuff up. And that's why you read it, and that's why you write it, is because of this wonderful world you've created that you want. And you might become more skilled at not doing the data dump, but still, there are people, many in this room, who eat that kind of stuff up. In fact, I was told once to cut 150 pages out of the book, and I had this scene where I had done this mindful research in how a letter was written in 16th century Turkey, and that they dusted it with gold and that they smooth it first like this, and they have, you know, I had the whole thing. Because they had these letters, but these letters were actually written to Queen Elizabeth I from this woman. And boy, that was great research, and I just got those details. And I said, well, okay, I'll take this scene out, because that did seem quite sort of data dumpy. And my editor said, no, keep that. That's the part. The other stuff goes, not that.
I think an important thing to ask yourself is this in a one or the other? Is it an either or? And I don't think that it is. I don't think your two choices are to do an info dump or to just abandon all of the research that you've done. I think the question is, when are you starting to sacrifice the story? Right? When are the details no longer in service to the story? And I have an example from a historical piece that I wrote that was about the ancient Olympics. And I learned about how the athletes would clean themselves. They didn't have soap and things like that, so they would rub oil all over their bodies, and then they'd use a stick called a sturgeon, and they would scrape this off, and they'd fling it in buckets. And this goop was collected and bottled and distributed as elixir. It was supposed to heal everything. People would put it on wounds. They would even ingest it. And that was just such... It's so revealing of this culture. Right? And so could have been used in service to the story. But the scene where I had intended to put that as I wrote it, there wasn't a way to get it in there with the narrative. And so I left it out, as much as I loved that. I anticipated being able to use it there. When I researched it, I knew I was going to use it there. But when I wrote it, it didn't fit. And because it didn't fit, I didn't cram it in. My personal philosophy is, I'm not going to take a time out in the story for anything. I want to reward my reader with story on every single page. There are people who read for ideas.
There are a lot of people who read for transport, who really want to, they feel connected to that age and that place. And for those readers, you can't put in too much detail. And that's why I always feel like it's sort of a matter of personal taste. At some point, for me, I go, oh, that's too much detail. I'll just skip, to get back to the story. Or I'll say, this is really great. Why in the heck did you bother writing a novel when you could have just written some nonfiction?
But I think that that's what you need to decide to do. When you're deciding how much detail you're going to put in, are you wanting to tell this great action story where the kid goes and he becomes the king because he fights every... Or are you wanting to show maybe a slice of life from the ancient Olympics or something like that? And there, that's where you kind of find your balance, because in Sun and Moon, it's a fairy tale. It's basically a Beauty and the Beast. If you're not familiar, it's east of the sun, west of the moon. But for the first half, I wanted to show how this girl was so unwanted by her family that they would give her to the polar bear that knocked on the door and asked for the youngest daughter. So I started out the story with, this is life in a very poor family in 19th century Norway. This is the life of an unwanted daughter. She's the one darning the stockings, and she's the one making lefset, kind of like a big tortilla made with potato flour, and they have specific tools. If you've ever been to European Connect and gotten a crepe, it's the same system. They've got a flat stick that they whip and fold the thing over with and stuff. So
I showed for doing that in the first half. In the second half, details went out the window and we got our story because she was moving on to a different realm. And so I think you have to decide what you're trying to do with each part of your story. Do you want to illuminate about the world or your period of history, or are you fighting?
But don't spare us the details in the battles either.
Yeah,
because I think there are lots of great battles.
Unless you're Victor Hugo and you're describing the field of Waterloo and what it was used for in years before the battle of Waterloo. First they grew grain. Potatoes.
I think selecting your details. I once heard in a panel somebody say, only give the lies to the bad guy, even though we know everybody had lies in it. So, you know, if you're wanting to make your bad guy really slimy, you know, he has the lies.
At least his henchmen do.
Yes.
No henchmen always have lies.
But never our heroine.
No.
But I just made the choice recently to, it's a book set in Arabia, and how you wash your hair in Arabia with limited water is you go out in the morning when the camels first stand up and you catch the piss. And it's nice and warm and it gets rid of lice and all that kind of stuff. And that's how you wash your hair. And my heroine is...
There's nice hair there.
They do.
I
should try
that.
Yes.
The luscious waves in there.
You know, sometimes the details are so fascinating, they sort of beg to be thrown into a story somewhere. And you know, when I saw this existentialist chain of thought, I have a novel, I think it was Worldfinder, where I have a character who is thrown into thrown into a dungeon. But an oubliette, yes. The oubliette, which is basically where people are urinating, and you know, it's and I remember actually being in England and, you know, kind of looking down into the water and thinking, you know, God, what's it going to be like to be down there and this kind of thing. When I was young, I'd had a calf that wandered out into this ditch where we used to throw all of the manure from the barn. And it was just after a big rainstorm, so it was like sinking into quicksand, and the poor thing sank in there. We couldn't figure out whatever happened to the calf until finally, you know, it dried out, like, you know, 6 months later, and there he is. So I just thought, like, I'm going to combine that, you know. This is what it's like to be thrown into the oubliette, and, you know, if you're in there and it's deep enough, you can't sit down, you can't rest, you can't sleep, because if you do, you're going to drown, you know. And anyway, I have a lot of people who, you know, said, oh, that was so cool. Where did you ever come up with that? Because it comes up through research, you know. Research is the fun part of brainstorming for me, because I like to study and read about the age that I'm writing in, the culture that I'm writing in, and when you find those fascinating differences, like how you wash your hair, you know, immediately it begs, okay, that's got to go in a scene somewhere, you know. It becomes a problem that you have to solve. How do I work it in?
And I once heard some editors talking, and they had a word called the vehicle, which I had never heard before or since, to describe something physical that's in the scene that sort of carries through the scene and is the vehicle. And I think that details are particularly good for this sort of thing.
Well, especially if you're doing something like making your bread, where it's an act that has a beginning, you know, she could be sitting there turning over her bread and frying it, and all through that there can be scenes.
There is a conversation.
Conversation going on. And so, you know, finally she's, you know, fries the bread and finds out she's burned it and dumps it, you know, just as she's realizing that she's about to be dumped, you know, something like that.
The dog can talk.
That becomes a really good...
as they're making the bread.
Yes, that can be a really good vehicle for having a completion in the scene is basically what
I what you just said, that it has something to do with the emotional arc of the scene as well.
Yeah.
That if, you know, if it's burned, then, you know, that has something to do with the emotion. At the moment, I'm working on a scene which I just got critique that there's too much. There is not time in one evening to do all the tattooing I'm describing. See, I got all this wonderful tattooing description.
Henna or
tattooing. with ash, pricking with a camel ball, pricking ash into your skin, which has been many.
You just have a Mexican do it.
They're quick. Yeah. Anyway, but I have all this wonderful detail. So which is going to, you know, which of the things she gets done on her? Because you do this, you know, when you were bored over many years, you know, oh, now I want this and now I want that, you know, yeah. like people do now. So I can't have all of her things done all in one night. So
why not? On prison break the other day, they removed all of his tattoos in one night.
And
he was scar-free the next
day. In some societies, when they do tattoos, like if a young person, young man reaches manhood, then he has to get a bunch of tattoos. And ceremonial tattoos may be done by as many as 6 or 8 people at once. But okay, you guys take this arm, you guys take that arm, we'll get the back, you guys get the neck, the face afterwards. So you might
something
like that.
Yeah, well, anyway,
so
I have
gang tattooing. Nice.
No, it is, actually. I have a friend who is tattooed in Samoa as a child. And there were 6 people working on him while the wives of the tattooers sang to him and stuff to distract him. It was a big thing. And one day, he has it on videotape. It's fascinating. His parents filmed it.
As you do research, you will get about 50-100 times as much research as you can ever use in any one story or book. And so how do you choose what goes in? Because you don't pick the 1% or the 0.5% that is good and the rest of it is not good. One question that I would give you is to ask yourself, what does this say about the people that I'm writing about? When we read stories, we read because we're interested in people. That's really the only thing that we have any chance to understand whatsoever. Right? When we were reading about these practices, these mores, these items, these artifacts, they're all different ways of getting at the culture, which is the people. And so, if you're thinking about putting a detail in there, ask, so what does this say about the culture and the people that I'm writing about? If it's not particularly revealing, then it probably isn't the type of detail that you want to put in. The details that we've been talking about here are important, and they say something about your characters, which means that you're not putting the story on hold by addressing it. You are furthering characterization and thought and things of that nature.
In fact, I try to look for the details. I try to look for the elements that reveal the characters.
Absolutely.
Exactly. They're so fundamentally a part of them that it serves as a form of characterization for the culture, the time, the person in particular, all of that.
Diana Gabaldon once was asked, how do you do your research and you write it down? And she says she never writes it down when she's doing her research, because if it's good enough, Linda will remember.
Yeah.
Well, she's younger than I. I remember this kind of stuff.
Well, that's the illusion, though. When you're young, you think you'll remember it, but as you get older, you discover that you've forgotten it all.
I actually do that, because that to me is kind of the filter. Like, I'll read a bunch of books about something, and then what stuck out in my head, then that's.
You know what?
Because I know, like you say, I know how to churn butter. I don't need to describe how to churn, unless there is a reason why that character is doing that. So I think what we've been saying is, talking about the camel piss shampoo and stuff like that. The things that stick in your mind are going to be the things that are going to illuminate your story. They're going to make it stand out. They're going to show an aspect of this world or time period that we have not seen before. Mm-hmm. And so. I use the mental filter. If you throw it at the wall and it sticks, then the pasta is done.
This brings up another interesting question, which is artistic license.
Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with it.
Because whenever
you're historical,
Oh, drives me nuts.
Well, let's talk about navigating that question.
Yeah.
Because the very act of telling a story is recreation. There's artifice from the beginning. So the level of veracity that you're seeking, you have to decide upon. And because we're writing for contemporary audiences, there's a level where we cannot represent things as true to form as we're capable of writing them. Right? If we were to portray the mores of the average, or even the exceptional medieval feminist, women would be incredibly offended. So how do you represent a marriage from 1,000 years ago in another culture in a way that a modern reader can identify and yet still do justice to that culture? Would anybody like to make a comment on this idea of artistic license?
No, that's a scary topic. I want to avoid it.
I mean, just the simple stuff of, you know, you're writing about people who don't speak the same language you do. So how colloquial are you going to be? I know I have some critiquers who, you know, every contraction I use, they say, don't use contractions because that, you know, that takes away from the...
They used contractions.
Yes,
and
exactly.
We didn't invent the contraction in the
70s. but then sometimes I just had a big issue yesterday. Just because I know the plural of all these Arabic words, is it confusing to the reader when I put the, you know, I have the word that I use and then I do the plural? And they get confused because while it becomes awlad, starting with a different letter. This is so confusing that I shouldn't throw that at your average reader. So, you know, but genie becomes jinn, I think people can handle that. So I have to make these choices, and I keep a style sheet to let me remember which one I used and which one I didn't use.
And do you notice what she's using to guide her? She's saying, how is it going to be received?
The reader, yeah. I really think you need to look at your audience, because I'm writing for kids. I'm writing for teens and even younger, like 10 and up. They're not going to be able to handle things like, now that she was married, she wasn't allowed to look out the window because another man might see her. You know, they're not gonna get that unless I'm really, you know, illustrating how repressed someone was or something. I think you really need to look at your reader and what your goal is. Are you writing basically nonfiction, thinly veiled nonfiction, to show your reader what this was really like, or are you entertaining them? Are they old enough to handle that, you know, that level of veracity.
Yeah. I also think that that details can be helpful, especially for minor characters. I had a minor character who was the wife of a linen draper, and she's just a small little character, but she is sort of this walking advertisement for her husband. And so every time I had her, I did something to do with the linen trade to describe her, like her eyes were as blue as a flax blue, you know, and that kind of stuff, because she's this walking advertisement. Right. And, you know, if you get, like, you know, if this is the milkmaid, you know, you latch onto something that can, you can find, you know, just throwing these little details in, and the detail. And I've said this before at the same con, because it's so memorable to me. I read a historical novel that never took place in the kitchen. It was all battles and stuff. You know? And but the kid at his first battle, he said his mind was spinning like one of those little dogs in the kitchen that spins the spit.
Spit-turner
dog. You know, I mean, he said it much more gracefully than that. But to me, that's a brilliant detail, because it's the metaphor in a completely different place, but it's not anachronistic, and it's like the whole world is there created behind.
It shows that he has been in the kitchen, even though the reader has.
Yeah,
been.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And like the
that.
Whole
yeah.
world is there behind this guy. It's not just this battle scene. It's you know, his mother he's fighting for and all this.
Yeah, something about using detail for especially your minor characters is, remember she said details, and this fleshes them out, it differentiates them. Don't do
character eye patch and character scar over his eye. Don't give one detail that differentiates the character. You know, this is the guy with the big nose.
The one guy in 14th century France with lice.
If you have a character and all you're doing to distinguish them from other people is saying that they're the person with the eye patch or they're the person with the scar, they're not a character.
Right. You know, there are certain cases where you've got a really minor character, you know, that you might want to do that. Right? You know, if you've got a doorman, you know.
Usually you have the two. Strong, dumb one, and the skinny little. Usually,
there's something. It's a shorthand way of doing that kind of thing. But if the person's ever talking, don't do that. You know. Yeah.
If they're more than just a function.
If they have more of a line than yes sir, then they need more than just an eye patch. But my pet peeve is when they have obviously taken pains to set up a world. They keep harping on the fact that, like, oh, in society, you know, she cannot go out alone, you know, this lady of society, she can't, you know, they make all this fuss, and then they, like, blow the most basic details. I read a book, it was a romance, trashy romance novel, but there's a reason why I read it, I promise. where they kept making a fuss over the social status and how she liked this guy who was below her, and she went to a ball and she had to wait to be introduced to someone by a third party, you know, she couldn't talk to him, and they went through all this detail. This girl wore makeup. She sometimes wore pants around the house. This is early 19th century England. She sometimes wore pants around the house, but never left her room without her cosmetics. Which, you know, at the time, only like the scary old ladies with the total dead white paint or prostitutes wore. But this girl always wore her makeup, even if she was walking around in pants. And also, she would go outside and say, "Bring me the carriage," and put on her gloves and then get into the carriage. In about less than 5 minutes, they would have hitched up four horses and a traveling coach, and she would hop in.
My grandmother's sister was disowned and thrown out of the house at the age of 14 for wearing lipstick.
Exactly. Yes. So they had, you know, gone into such detail in other areas, but then basic things that the average person on the street could probably tell you.
Yeah.
They're just completely blown, and I don't know why, but things like that. If you're going to get into historical detail and make a big deal out of this is 19th century Russia, we don't do that here, you're going to need to check some of your other facts.
And this applies equally to speculative fiction, fantasy and science fiction. In one, you're using the historical details, and the other, you're establishing the details and the rules, but once the rules are given, you can't break them. Right?
And the data dump can also be a pitfall in both cases. I sometimes probably set this at the same con too. I give to kids in schools, you know, I go and talk about writing historical fiction, and I have a little mug of cocoa for them, and I say, there are plenty of people out there that like the froth on the top, that's their favorite part of the mug of cocoa, and there's many people who like the sludge at the bottom. I tend to write down at the sludge part, but you have to know, you know, if you promise your people at the first, in your first pages, it's going to be this froth, that's fine, they'd like it, but you cannot have froth and then later give a sludge. I mean, it's sort of...
You make promises in the start of every story that you write. And you know, many times, I remember, you know, as a judge for Writers of the Future, I would give a story, for example, that had this wonderful comic opening, and then the whole story would turn serious after about five pages. And it was a good, serious story, but you just felt it was somehow wrong. It took me probably a couple of years before I realized that I was running into this problem over and over again, that people were making false promises to me. And the same is true with your historic or any novel that you write, you're making false promises when you start out.
So certainly there are romance novels. We're picking on this.
It was just the one book
that is fraught, and that and people would be offended if you gave them anything else. But that's what you promised.
Yeah, and don't look at your readers and say that they're pejorative, because this is the way that the story works. As soon as they pick up that book, it is in their mind that this book is other than me. This is not real. They know that. You have to overcome that. You have to get them to identify. And you do that by establishing rules where they feel that they can operate and they can understand the mechanics of this world. You start breaking those mechanics, and they can't identify. They don't feel that this is a real thing. They can't care about it. It becomes irrelevant to them. If you break your own rules, if you break your own system, you are destroying the mechanism by which your story becomes relevant. It's a big, big deal. And even if somebody, the reader, can't understand why they feel something is off about this story, they will feel it and they'll put your book down on it.
I think we're done.
No, we got about another 20 minutes.
Oh.
I just feel stuff like that. You know, that Sally can come back.
This conversation came to the natural end of an awkward pause.
I would like to go back to this idea of how do you write true to a period when people during that period would act in ways that are offensive to us now. Because to a certain degree, I want to capture that. Because part of the reason why I'm fascinated by writing historical fiction and fantasy and science fiction is because I want to examine these differences.
In what way? What is offensive to you? I don't understand your point, actually.
Well, take for example a culture that takes slavery as an actual, natural, inherent given.
Does that bother you?
Yeah.
It actually crops up quite frequently in a lot of fantasy books.
Exactly. And so when you make a hero, when you make a protagonist, who you want people to identify with and to admire.
Does every protagonist have to be
a slave owner?
Or an abolitionist? I mean, if your protagonist
they don't, and that's what I'm saying, but how do you write somebody who believes something that your reader doesn't and still make them identifiable? And one of the techniques that I use is every time I portray something that the reader is going to feel friction with, I try to reinforce that with an area of commonality.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yes. Yeah. And so if you're just portraying a person all of their distinctions,
I think you can go beyond that, though. I mean, you know, you can look for commonality, but also look for things that are, you know, actually laudable about that person. You know, typically a hero, for example, is highly motivated, is driven. They may be courageous. They may be willing to step outside the bounds of what's considered normal, and that kind of thing. And I look at someone like Cleopatra, who I am sure owned, you know, probably a couple million slaves, and yet she was a remarkable person and a fascinating person. And so I can look at that and say, yeah, okay, so she had slaves, you know, but she was nice to them, you know.
Also, have you seen the actual casting of her face? Holy cow. Her nose and chin about met.
But everyone who met her fell in love with her immediately.
Because of her seductive powers. I'm saying that, you know, when you're portraying her.
And you see how
she was a fascinating person.
Well,
she
knew
so much going on.
Too.
So it's
she painted the slaves gold and they died. I forgot about that.
Well, everybody did, and I think if you make a case for not just commonality between us and them, but also if you're making the point everyone owns slaves. It's not like this dude owns slaves. His next door neighbor, however, is an abolitionist. I think. Hang on, just one second. I move over there. And you too. Anne Carey writes the historical mysteries. Does a fantastic job in the very first Charlotte and Thomas Pitt book, The Cater Tree Hangman. Charlotte discovers that her
brother-in-law that she has a crush on occasionally sleeps with the maid when her sister is indisposed, and is quite shocked and mentions it to the mother, who basically says, everyone does that. And she kind of has to accept it for the brother-in-law, but when she gets married, she says, in our marriage, I do not want that, and he agrees to it. You know, they kind of set their own rules, as she's not being totally groundbreaking. She's not saying, I am going to go campaign for the rights of maids everywhere that don't want to sleep with their master. She's saying, in my household, I do not want that. She still respects her brother-in-law, you know, because she understands that that is the way his brain works, and it does not work for her. So I think that you can, you know, you can do this very well. It's, the book is still very authentic.
That's great. I had, we had a...
The Jawa's freaking out, I'm sorry.
I always wanted to own a Jawa.
You want to own a Jawa?
We had an issue at the Historical Novel Society that is still with us today, where the moderator of one panel, halfway into the panel, just laid into the guest of honor because this moderator had wonderfully read everybody's books on the panel, but he just laid into the guest of honor for being homophobic because his lead character in historical fashion, you know, found in one section, found this guy who was a little effeminate and didn't like him. And so he just laid into him for being homophobic, and how could he possibly put that in his novel? Well, this guy's not been invited back to be a moderator ever again. But he does come up to me in other conferences where we go to and just lay into me because we were so awful to him. Because we didn't like him offending us.
You have to tell us what it is now.
If you're writing about other cultures, and you and your reader aren't in some ways challenged, at least a little bit, in terms of your assumptions, then you're not writing historical fiction or fantasy.
You know, I was showing some authors the movie Rocky a couple of weeks ago, which I enjoyed, you know, back 30 years ago. But there's this sex scene in Rocky where Rocky basically gets Adrian up against the wall and is like talking to her, got his shirt off, you know, and finally pulls her down and onto the floor. And I'm going, you know, that was so creepy. That just weirded me out. You know, 30 years ago, you know, as a teenager, I don't remember being bothered by it. I remember thinking it was a little bit off. But
it was madly.
But you know, it was so far off today that I was like, oh my gosh, you know, what did I ever see in this movie? And Sylvester Stallone's a creep for having written it, you know. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, having lived in the ghettos of Chicago, you know, 30 years ago, it just seemed very natural and realistic for the way that people were acting around us at the time, you know. And so it was, you know, contemporary. But you're right, you know, if you take it only 30 years ago and I find something that offensive, you know, I have ancestors who were slave owners. And, you know, the family history, they talked about how when Wolvertons freed their slaves, you know, the slaves all were crying and saying, please, Massa, please, no, don't make me go, you know. And you know, but the you know, grandma had to make them go, and, you know, it was just brokenhearted to have to, you know, part with her children is the way that she saw them, you know. Well, you know what? That whole thing sickens me. I don't want to strike out with a bad history. I don't give a damn if they were nice slave owners. The fact that they were slave owners is disgusting to me, you know. But you know, that's how far we've come in 150 years. And if you go back 500 years, you know, then you're really getting into, you know, the treatment of women anywhere in any society was reprehensible, and I don't care if you're talking about Japan, the American Indians, there were no truly enlightened societies, and if you're trying to say that there was, you're lying, you know?
There are individual cases that I think people hold up and go, ah, but see, you know, yeah, there was Artemisia Gentileschi, yeah, who was raped for taking an art class.
200 years ago, you had nobles who would go out and hunt for naked women for sport in England. You know, that's what they would, you know, that was, okay, I can't remember.
Where are you doing this research?
I mean, yeah, these kinds of abuses were just phenomenal, you know. 200 years ago. Yeah, 1780s, yeah.
Maybe
we've got people questioning, yes.
I've taken a lot of stories. Someone just takes, like, a contemporary woman and sets her
up. Oh, God.
Some of the feminist issues.
That's the problem. You can't. Okay, if I drop a woman in, a modern woman, into my Rue Morgue's novel, then people will look at it and say, well, that's just totally unrealistic. That's so stupid, Dave. You're one of those dumb, romance writers who doesn't know that women don't wear pants. Okay. On the other hand, if I make her contemporary so that she's like women really would have been in the Middle Ages, then they're going to say, oh, Dave, you're what kind of monster are you? You're advocating treating women as sex slaves or something, you know? So you can't, there's no win. It's a no-win situation. Sorry.
And this gets at what we're actually doing. With all writing, with all storytelling, what we're trying to seek is the appearance of veracity. Right? We're not trying to duplicate reality. It can't be done. We're trying to give the appearance of that. We're trying to get at the truth rather than the fact.
What I think also works quite well is when you have a feminist for her time.
Yes.
You need to have someone like, and I highly recommend the Thomas and Charlotte Pitt books by Anne Perry for doing this well. We have Charlotte who wants to do more, wants to get out of the house. This is inspired by something in her childhood. Her parents have treated her in a fashion that this would be natural. Her parents are not repressive, they're quite open-minded. For their time period, they're educated people. So they've given her this grounding. She did not just pop out of a repressed society and go, yay, I want to vote, you know. there is a background to why she is the way she is. And within her society, she is working towards what her goals, but still following the rules of her society as much as she possibly can. You need to have someone who, you don't just spring a feminist out of some village who can't even read, and she's the one woman in the village who can read. Why is she the one woman in the village who can read?
Yeah.
You know, who was her father that he allowed her to read? You know, who taught her? Was there an outcry? Does she have detractors? Artemisia Gentileschi was a famous painter of, 15th century Italy or something like that. She went to an art class with male students, and one of them raped her after the class to put her back in her place. She accepted this, but continued to paint on her own. You know, within her society, she worked towards what she wanted. So I think you have to look at what the ultimate boundaries would be and press against them as much as you can.
And if you want people to admire your protagonist, which you usually do, you don't have to start with somebody that they're going to admire incredibly off the bat. They earn that admiration through how they change. That's the most important point, is over the course of this story, how do we see them evolve to become better, become more...
The basic high school English dynamic character.
It's a tough call, because I have, for example, a woman who was a feminist, a strong feminist, back in the 1800s, Mormon, was one of the first people to try to get voting rights for women in the United States and stuff like that. And I think, she's a wonderful hero, except that she was the wife of a polygamist. And I'm trying to think, how can you tell her story and do her justice? And, it's a really tough line to try to figure out how to draw.
Some women do enjoy polygamy.
I would find it very freeing.
I do. I can be the wife.
Okay.
Oftentimes we talk about the hot topics like feminism, where everyone has a voice and everyone has something to say, but there are also topics within history like religion, where instead of having something to say about it, we've just kind of pulled back and had nothing to say about it, or default to either modern contemporary Christianity or some sort of polytheistic, which isn't exactly how they would actually believe, or atheism within a context of a society where they would believe something, but the characters don't actually believe it. So I guess my question is just
there are certain things that, as authors, are difficult to touch. Mm-hmm. If you start
writing about someone who's a very small minority religion, you know, and you know, Mormonism is, you know, we're only the fifth largest church in the United States. So it's a fairly mainstream religion compared to a lot of others. And yet, you know, you have to worry about what your audience is going to think. You know, my first novel that I wrote, I had a Latin American, an old Latin American, as my protagonist, a Panamanian who's 70 years old, roughly. And I was kind of interested to see what they would do with my cover, and the cover put all of my people in spacesuits so that you could tell what they were. The first story that I wrote in Nazimov's, you know, I had a black character. They just made him white, you know, as an illustration. Just because we couldn't, you know, you can't do that. You know? So it's difficult historically to deal with some of these issues. I have some ideas. I think one thing is you have to show the reader why these people should be important to them, and why make them feel like that's part of their own culture, part of their own history. How does it tie into the rest of us? In other words, make it so that it's, try to make the stories inclusive, not exclusive. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Another challenge that comes with this is many people are very poorly informed about many other faiths, and there aren't many religions that you can treat as a culture in a book. You've got Catholicism because of its major role in history, and Judaism. Those are the two that come to mind.
But even so,
Islam.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, what
yeah,
I'm,
that's, really like, that's like the really big misunderstanding.
No, not Islam. Not Islam.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because, damn it, I'm going to do Islam.
Well, Islam.
Actually know a lot less about Islam and Judaism than they think, at least in this
Yeah, and it's not just the amount of knowledge, it's their willingness to see a character as being Jewish or as being Catholic, and that's not who they are. They don't imprint the stereotype onto the character. If you write an LDS character and you do not have anything about doctrine or dogma in there, readers say, I don't believe this. This person isn't Mormon. And that's a big problem. Is that
they use electricity.
Yeah.
They watch TV. And
yes. If you have an Islamist who isn't a terrorist. Oh.
Yeah.
This isn't real. And so that's a big problem. Is if your reader isn't willing to accept something as being accurate, even if it is accurate, then the communication can't happen. They participate in the construction of this story too.
Yeah.
One more.
I'm sorry, I pushed my arm up.
That's fine.
That's fine.
This was like 20 minutes ago.
yeah.
sorry.
It took us a while to get back around.
Dr. Michael Collins. At one LTUA to LTUV down at BYU made a statement that you really can't judge things that were written by Lord Byron by today's standards, because in the standards of his day they were really risque and very feminist, and today's standards would consider them absolutely oppressive.
Well, that's a different angle of issues that we're talking about right now. The same is true of, say,
go to Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. You know, he was criticized roundly for writing about nice Negroes and you know, trying to talk about freedom and treating them as equals and stuff like that. And then, yet today in many schools, he's blacklisted because he uses the N-word, you know?
Yeah.
or C.S. Lewis, you know, who's criticized for his Muslim or Middle Eastern.
Yes, I was recently reading something where someone was talking about how he was the ultimate in evil, C.S. Lewis was, because he was so oppressive towards, you know, Muslims. And I'm like...
Was it Philip Pullman? Philip Pullman.
It was a fascinating take from a complete lunatic, but I
love Pullman, but boy, when he rants about CS,
oh, absolutely,
drop and madness. But Guy Gabriel K thinks both Pullman and Lewis should be set on the time out stool. He told me because they're both their story is getting in the way of them choking you with their personal beliefs. You know, so.
I mean, you can judge these. I mean, you have the capacity. We all have the capacity and the power to it to do so. It's just that. Are you actually trying to look at what is admirable about this person? If so, it's foolish not to consider the constraints of their time and culture. And so,
again, it comes down to what we've been saying about reader, considering your readership. Are they going to judge this person? And of course, there's going to be someone who's going to be so offended at this or so offended at that. But in general, you know, and what are you trying to do? Tell the story or educate about what it would have been like at that time? So
and you need
to find your balance, basically.
And the C.S. Lewis's have stuck around. The fact that they've stuck around means that they can't have been too bad because they're still relevant.
I'm the only smart person.
You know, it was a brilliant, profound philosopher who did have a blind spot, quite frankly. That's what it comes down to.
And two of us here does not have that. We can't tell, though, and we can use a blind spot. You identify your blind spot. They don't have blind spot.
That's what a spouse is for.
So, I don't know. Here had a comment, like, forever ago.
Well, it was just a comment. Question. You were talking about what details to include on a character. For example, he was a slave owner or something. And there was a comment I read in, like, Orson Scott Card book that said, his flaws were the flaws of his time, and but his virtues were his own. And so I just wanted to bring that
up. I like that. That's a good one.
Yeah.
An excellent final statement.
Just one quick question for female writers who are writing female characters in old times. I mean, do you find yourself running into that problem a lot, where you're having to figure out, okay, how do I write this character the way I want to write them, or how do I also write them realistically, so that they're not, like we mentioned before, just a 21st century feminist plopped down in, you know, 13th century England or somewhere else? I mean, is that an extra big challenge, or, I mean, how do you...
It is. Because I would not let someone treat me that way, you know? I would, like, just punch him is what's going through my head. You have to stop and say, she can't punch him. What could she do? You have to keep kind of checking yourself.
She could really make some crummy chicken soup.
She could poison him. She couldn't punch him, you know?
I ask my wife those questions quite often. Like,
Charlie can't write every time I see her.
Would a woman do this?
Would a woman do this? You know, and she runs into that immediately. She's thinking, well, you know, I, of course, would knock the guy's head off. But, wait, would a woman who's really in 14th century wherever really do that? And so people sit there and scratch their head and say,
I have to say that I'm usually attracted to Joan of Arc.
We gotta go.
No, I think cultures have always had ways for women to work, and powerful ways for women to work, and those are the things I'm really interested in. I mean, that's why the flash from my Turkish books came from my belief that women were not complete idiots to.
I have a reading in the executive boardroom after this. So if you'd like to come.